though, as I said, I think, you know, before really seriously engaging on in a path, it's good to just know at the beginning that we have to make sacrifices. Otherwise we stress ourselves out.
Yeah, so,
and I think that's one of our, that's one of our problems. We want to be a benefit to others. We want to help others. We want to practice. But at the same time, we still want to have all the, you know, the pleasures that we used to have. We still want to do all the activities that we are used to do. So we're not ready to give up the things that we thought until now make us happy. So the more you can make a very, very clear choice, saying, well, if I want to, especially if you're new, but most of you are not new, but it's good to really have a look at your daily life, actually. Yeah? To see, like, what can I give up so I have more time, because there's always so much to do. Yeah? And of course, you know, things like, I'm not saying you're doing unhealthy things, like going to party and getting drunk or whatever, but even, you know, movies, theater, music, all that, even that is, it's taking time. I'm not saying it's harmful, but it takes time. And then we stress ourselves out by wanting to have the things that give us pleasure, and by, you know, doing formal practices like meditation and this and that. Very often, you know, with the music in the eighth, where if you take the eight Mahayana precepts, it's a kind of thing that you can. There's like eight vows that you take just for 24 hours. And one of them is like not playing or listening to music. And people say, why is that? What's so harmful about music? I tell you, if you do longer retreats, silent retreats, mindfulness retreats, you can have pieces of music stuck on your head that just don't stop. And it's really, this is why, you know, the mind gets so impregnated with that, with the music, that because it's attachment, right? And you want to get rid of it, but it just plays and plays and plays and plays and plays. And you laugh and have you notice it? Yeah. I mean, it's amazing with what the mind can come up, especially when you do longer retreats like that, silent retreats, right? Just sitting, just observing what's going on. Whatever comes, it's in daily life, it would be completely trivial. You wouldn't even follow it. Inside the retreat setting, it becomes so important, so big, so like it has to be dealt with right now. You know you're not supposed to follow your thoughts, but that thought, no matter how stupid it is, it comes with this quality of kind of, it's important, it has to be dealt with right now. I did a 1 month Vipassana retreat in February, and all of a sudden I had this thing, I had to figure out how many hours I still have to sit until the retreat was finished, you know, and I actually started calculating. I was like, stop. But no, it wanted to know. Yeah, but then I stopped. You know, this whole thing is, our mind is always going like that in the meditation. I'll deal with that and then there will be peace. But you deal with that, you give in to your desire of wanting to do something interesting and there will be no peace. It's the same as with attachment outside, you know. I just have this one coffee or this one cake and then there will be peace. There is no peace if we follow desire, because it's not in the nature of desire to be satisfied. Yeah. So we have to give up things that are, although not harmful, and can even be very uplifting. You see, it always depends how you look at it. Yeah. So, like, music can be very uplifting, and then if you use it in order to be able to practice better, that's great. But all those things in general, we use it just to feel better now. And then what's the purpose? That's the purpose. And because that purpose is not very big, again, it makes the mind small, and then all the happiness that comes from it goes very quickly. Because it's just based on me, you know? Kind of, if you ask people, everybody wants to be happy. And if you would actually ask somebody, really, you know, surprising like this, but why do you want to be happy? You know, everybody wants to be happy, nobody wants to suffer. But if you would ask, or ask yourself, no, but why? Of course, if the spontaneous thought comes up, because if I'm not happy, I cannot be benefit to anybody else, that's fine. But most of the people would know what to say. Why? Janet, why do you want to be happy? Yeah, right. Yeah, and our whole energy goes into this whole thing of being happy, and then we go, why? Just for the sake of being happy.
Well, it's like it's
oh, microphone.
I mean, in a way, like, to me, it, being happy means that I'm not suffering.
Right, okay.
And, you know, so, like, why would I want to be happy? Well, that would mean I'm not suffering. So being happy is better.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Somehow like that. Yeah. But, you see, we mistake, like, the whole thing also is, like, we have no renunciation. Why? Because we are running after happiness that is not real happiness. We're running after pleasant feelings. And because we're attached to pleasant feelings, this is why we mistake them for being happy, because not having pleasant feelings, then that creates suffering. So having a pleasant feeling, that alleviates the suffering for just a short moment. But because it's done with the mind of desire, then there's another, you know, it starts again. The unpleasant feeling of wanting something comes again. We have trained the mind to want, so we're addicted to our wanting. And we don't see that not wanting, you see when you hear the words unattached, not wanting, and cessation of suffering, one thinks of a death, you know, one thinks one is dead. We can't imagine having a mind that doesn't want, then we think, oh my gosh, that would be very boring. So it's not like that. It's then there will be space and peace, and you know, and the wisdom maybe, and the skills to be of benefit to others. The same way as we are benefit now. We're very clever trying to make ourselves comfortable, happy, whatever. We think about this a lot. Yeah? So then the same way, the mind will reach out to others. And then that will create the causes for happiness. You see, we make the big mistakes, and when you come to karma, and you're discovering Buddhism, you'll start to understand how that works. A pleasant feeling arises due to an action from the past which was virtuous. It's not the object. The object is just the condition to wake up that karmic imprint. But just being concerned with our own happiness doesn't create any virtuous seeds. So although now we have a pleasant feeling from desiring something and then getting it, that we think then it's the coffee or whatever that gives us this pleasant feeling, it's not. It's our previous imprint from probably from a past life. Even. So now, having the opportunity in our life to follow all those moments of attachment and desire actually creates exactly the opposite. It creates imprint, so we will not find pleasure, pleasant feelings in the future. You see, one always thinks like pleasure, like first one needs to want in order to have a pleasant feeling. But why do you want? It's like first is the pleasant feeling and then you want. That's the thing. There's no beginning to that. You know, why is there desire? Because your mind remembers something from the past, something that was pleasant. And it can't be the object, because if it's the object who gives you the pleasant feeling, the same object should give you the same feeling every time. If it's the object, logically speaking. That's what if you want to have microphone. Going all the way to the back. I don't know if it reaches there. You might have to come back forward.
So, if you're able to get rid of that wanting, then those positive seeds from the past, how would they then manifest themselves?
When they meet the conditions, the same as the negative ones? You see, karma only ripens when it meets conditions. So you might have a lot of positive imprints from virtuous actions. But as long as the outside object condition is not there to wake them up, then there will be no pleasant feelings, no happy feelings.
But if we were able to get rid of the wanting part...
Yeah. You will still have a mind who engages with objects.
And you'd still get those pleasant feelings without creating negative ones going forward.
Yeah, so you don't need desire to have pleasure. That's what we don't understand, you know? Because the more desire you have, actually, the more difficult it is to find pleasure. The more desire you have, the bigger the fear of loss. The more desire you have, you shorten, actually, that, you know, that moment of happiness from a pleasant feeling, because it's like there's all this wanting again. You see, desire or attachment, if you don't go on a more subtle level, it feels pleasant. something feels pleasant because we already anticipate the relief from the wanting by getting the thing, that we create another imprint. And we can see the more you try to fulfill your desires, those people, the more they have to get. If you look at very rich people who have everything, bringing them a present is so difficult. Just to wake up their mind for a little bit of happiness, you know, it's so difficult. Why? Because they have everything, seemingly. Maybe, I don't know, if you go visit rich people, we can say, look, I didn't even try to find something that you don't have yet, and that would be good enough for you, so maybe you tell me what you want. You can have some of my time, or I can go and clean your windows if you want, over there, as a present, you know, something like that.
I like not getting presents.
Huh?
I like not getting presents.
You like not getting presents. Yeah, I don't mind. Me also, if you don't live anywhere, you know, then getting lots of presents is always a problem. And actually, this whole thing about, but this doesn't really go into that. It's like, yeah, because if you give somebody something that they don't like, then they're stuck with it. They don't know what to do. They don't want to hurt your feelings. Yeah, and then they have to keep it for the rest of their life. As if, you know, we kind of make this condition as if we keep everything that we get or that we buy. So we want from them that they keep everything that we give them. Just imagine, how would your house look if you would have kept everything that you ever bought? Yeah, oh gosh. So it's okay for them to, it's okay, it was enough, people just rolled their eyes. But that was the answer. A very good answer. So like this, so if you, and again it sounds a bit cold-hearted, but it's actually not, it's actually quite the opposite. You give something to somebody and you say, look, if you ever want to give it away or even throw it away, it's fine. It seems as if we don't care about the present, but we then, maybe we don't care about the present if we say that, but we care about the person. Yeah? Whereas if they're not allowed to throw it away, we only care about me and my present. So people get used to that.
Yes.
When we do that though, then it's really not a gift. Because we're not really giving it away. If we were really giving it away, it wouldn't matter if they threw it on the floor in front of us and jumped up and down on it.
Exactly.
As long as that was what made them happy.
Yeah, if we really just care about the person, then they are allowed to do with that present whatever they want. But you know how it is, sometimes you get things and you go, oh my gosh, what should I do with this? But we wouldn't say anything. You know? I think the problem with us is that we buy things that we like, that I like, and then we assume that the other person has to like this as well. This is what I like, and this is how I show my appreciation to the other person. It's ridiculous. You know, the Tibetans actually, with their generosity and when they give presents, they give money. It's great, because whatever the person buys with this money, this is not your present. You never have this kind of, the same mind. You know, even if the person says, look, I've bought this pair of shoes, or a tanka or a statue with your money. Yeah? You never have the same, I don't know how to say in English, you don't claim so much on that present, my present, as when you buy it. So it's actually quite a good thing. Then they can buy whatever they want, you know. But for us this seems, you know, giving money is like bad taste. It's bad taste. It seems as if you don't care about the person because you can't be bothered to go out and buy something for them. But since we're buying anyway the things that I like, it's very difficult to buy something that you don't like, but you know exactly the other person likes it. It's very difficult to buy this as a present. Even you know that they would like this. Yeah, the ego stuff. So that can be a practice also. You know, when you go and buy presents, you look at the state of mind. Why do I want to bring a present? Yeah? I like bringing presents, but I really like to bring small things, you know, not valuable things. Because the people that know me, they know by now also they can give it away. People throw it away or whatever. But it does, see, it's nice to think about the people when you go and you know things, and you really think, well, what? But the more you think, what would really, what they would really like, the more, the less you can find things. You know, I was so excited when I found this little prayer wheel. I was so excited, and then I come here. So we want to bring something special, right?
Yeah.
So I found that I hardly ever go to the shops in Dharamsala, and Dharamsala is full of shops. Mm. So I found little prayer wheels, which are really cute, mm. and I was so excited. And when I came to Land of Medicine, well, they sell them in the shop there, so I'm like, ooh. But I still gave them away, because they're still cute.
They must have gone to the same shop, I see.
Yeah, probably they bought them in the same. Yes, please.
You know when we do the 7-minute prayer?
Yeah.
We see our teacher and we give our teacher a gift. Are we supposed to give the teacher a gift that we want?
In the 7-minute prayer? In the 7-minute prayer, exactly the same way as we did with the food, yes, you visualize giving something that you like very, very much. And in that would be the Western mind. The Tibetan mind, right, the Tibetan mind gives water for drinking, water for washing the feet, flowers, incense, light, perfume, food, and music. Those are the offerings for the senses. So that's what you offer, and you offer magnificent, pure, pristine, you know, extraordinary, exquisite, in abundance. Oceans and oceans and clouds and clouds. That's to make your mind leap. So you're not just offering one flower. You visualize like waves or oceans of flowers, clouds of flowers that you're offering. It's just to make the mind very deep. To learn how to give in abundance and not to be so calculating. So there in the 7-minute prayer, in all the offerings that one offers to the deities, it's those 8 things. So you don't have to think, you don't have to know what shall I offer. So it's what you, it's what is on the altar, because those are the very traditional Indian offerings. And actually we have it here as well, because what do you do in the 7-minute prayer? You invite the Buddhas, and then you do those 7 limbs, for those people who are not familiar with it, which are 7 different minds. It's the mind of prostrating, a humble mind who appreciates the presence of the teacher. It's the mind of offering. Through this mind you appreciate, you want to do something. By giving something the mind opens, and then you can confess without being too destroyed. Yeah. Then the mind kind of sinks down a bit. And in order to bring it back up, you rejoice. You rejoice with your own merit, merit of all other beings. Then you ask the teachers to remain and teach the Dharma. This is very important so that we from our own side, we kind of we check, am I really open to these 6 teachings? Do I really want them? Do I want to hear them? Mm-hmm. If not, then there's no point practicing if you can't practice. You need to want to do the practice, otherwise your lazy mind complains all the time. It's too difficult, it's too hard, I can't do this, like that. You know? The more you want, and not, by the way, not every wanting is desire ever, to be perfect. It's only called desire when it leads to suffering. This wanting of practicing in order to attain enlightenment is like posing for aspiration, not desire. Because also the aspiration, especially in the Mahayana tradition, is for the benefit of all others. That's not good. But we have to really carefully look at our own mind. Is it desire for just more happiness for myself? Or is it, desire because I want to be famous or well known or liked or whatever, can be anything, We don't know other people's intentions, we only know our own. And this one we have to check. Spiritual practice can be just as much desire as anything else. It's not the spiritual practice who makes it not desire but aspiration. It's your own mind who makes this desire or aspiration. You can eat the chocolate out of the ice cream out of aspiration. You feel your mind is very tight. What? Your mind is very tight. And the only thing that helps is ice cream. And then you think, because afterwards then I can meditate much better, you eat an ice cream. Fine. But you can also fool yourself into good motivation and then it's not there. And you're not cheating anybody but yourself. That's actually even worse negative karma, I guess, if you're kind of faking and it's not there, you know. But you see, if the and this is why I'm saying, if you start having right motivation, you see how quite quickly actually your mind changes. And you become more peaceful and more open and have less suffering already in this life. Even, it seems as if nothing changes, it's the same as when you do physio, the pain goes gradually. If you keep doing it, you know, slowly, slowly, at the right pace. Also, you're not doing that exercise the whole day, 24 hours. You do it in the right measure. So you need to know that also, how to practice in the right measure. Not too much, not too little. So, and then the last of those seven limbs is like you dedicate. Yeah? You make sure to reaffirm to yourself why you're doing all this. So it's a very complete practice, the seven limbs. And you create seven different kinds of minds, mind states with the seven limbs. And when you say the words, at the beginning maybe you have to meditate on this a little bit. So you feel your mind going into that state, the state of appreciating the teacher, the state of wanting to offer something. And as I'm saying, it's the same thing. You have somebody that you appreciate very much and they come to visit you. So they enter your house. What's the first thing? Yeah. Would you like something to drink? Water for drinking. Then you need to go to the bathroom. If you're attentive. You know, very often people have to ask themselves. And that's one thing, as if you travel with Tibetan monks, they don't. But you have to ask them. Unless you need to go to the bathroom. Otherwise the whole day they don't go to the bathroom, nobody's asking them. that's the extent of their like being hungry and not demanding anything. They need to know those things. So, or do you want to wash your hands? Yeah. And then what else? Very often we go out and buy flowers. Fresh flowers, put them on the table. The flowers are going to the office. We light a candle. And we have dinner. We put on some music. Maybe if people like incense, then we put on some incense. Or otherwise, you know, if there's a lot of cooking smell in the dining room, you go, shh, you have the perfume. So we still do the same thing. It's actually not that much Indian or Asian. Exactly something. So this is what you offer. Things for the senses. And you see, by offering sense objects to the Buddha, we create the karma that whatever our senses meet in the future, it will produce bliss in our mind. At the moment what is happening is that when whatever our senses meet, be it a form, a sound, a smell, a taste, or a touch, it creates either attachment, aversion, or indifference. All of those two minds are negative, create more negative karma. And it goes automatically, we don't see. We have to be very careful. See, the moment we go, that's so beautiful, we have another imprint of attachment because we choose. This is beautiful and this is not. If you are realized, whatever your mind touches, everything is beautiful. It's not that, you see, detached and equanimous doesn't mean everything is boring. Detached and equanimous means everything is not exciting, but everything is beautiful, everything is like you're completely in the object, but without attachment, by seeing the reality. Does that sound a bit more interesting now to become a Buddha when it says that whatever you see, you don't have to go and search for beautiful objects anymore. Everything that appears to your mind is pure and beautiful. You can't imagine that. It's so difficult for us to imagine how that could not be boring. It's so difficult. This is why the Dalai Lama is always happy. Like, you know, always, he's not always happy, it's not the right word. But this is why his suffering falls off very quickly. You see, when he hears some bad news, he gets very disturbed, very often he cries, but he goes very quickly. Very quickly. Why? Because he has a disciplined mind. He doesn't dwell on it. Therefore, if he doesn't dwell on the thought what produced this unfortunate situation, then also the emotion that comes with it passes, goes on. He doesn't dwell on things that are not beneficial to dwell on. Because he knows if I dwell on that thought, how the Tibetans get harmed by the Chinese, very quickly he will have anger. So he lets go of that thought. Because him being in Brahma's body, it doesn't mean he ignores it, or that he doesn't think about the situation per se. Yeah, he's definitely thinking a lot about how to make the situation better in Tibet, not just in Tibet, that's in all the world.
Yeah, but he understands that.
So his mind is equanimous. You know, when even he said, you know, Mao Zedong was my best teacher. I'm so grateful to him. Because he taught me patience. Without somebody making you suffer, you cannot practice patience. You need somebody who makes you suffer. Otherwise, you cannot practice patience. We're not patient from birth. Look at babies, how impatient they are. Little bit of suffering. Babies understand the first noble truth. Heat is dissatisfying. Cold is dissatisfying. Hunger is dissatisfying. Wet pants is dissatisfying. Falling down is dissatisfying. They understand this. They're disturbed by that. Problem is, as we grow up, see, they see themselves as patient. They complain. But then the problem is, as we grow up and we complain about those things that are so dissatisfying, what do people say? You know, if you hit your foot on the chair and you go, ah, like a child. Don't be such a baby. The babies have a right to do this, but we don't. Why? Otherwise. We cover up the first noble truth. We desperately try to cover it up. So then we're not seeing ourselves as the patient anymore. Suffering from the sickness of birth, old age, sickness, death, having what we want, not having what we want, desiring things, not finding them, all those things, you know. Insecurity, uncertainty, desires cannot be, like unsatisfactoriness, being completely alone in that whole process. Having to be reborn again and again and again and again in order to die again and again and again and again and again. We're not disturbed enough. And we're not disturbed enough by that because now we're quite okay. And we're quite sure the next life, oh, I'll be a human. Not sure. Not sure. You know, we have this false sense of being secure. This is why when a bomb falls that everybody is so shaken. It shouldn't happen. This is why when you hear that somebody died young, you know, you're kind of, how can that be? Because you can die any moment, but we're not aware of that. This is another thing why we don't have much energy to practice, is because we work for trivial things that at the time of death we have to leave behind. They seem to be more important than to stand on next life. We don't think about impermanence of death. So, thinking about the precious human rebirth, now we have the best opportunity to create the karma in order to be happy in the future. Because we're not threatened by anybody, we have our mind together, we have a body that is more or less healthy. And that it's very rare to get that situation. And especially that it's very fragile. So those are meditations that will really help you in your path to get going. Think about this. You know, as we did the meditation we did this morning, if I see where does the mind spontaneously go? If I would die now, I would have died with this state of mind. What was it planning? To put olive oil on the salad? What will I be reborn as a cow or a rabbit? I'm more interested in the salad than in that. Maybe a worm in an olive tree or something. I'm not joking. Because attachment is going to throw us where we are interested to be, and so that was the salad for me. Who likes salad? Rabbits and cows. I don't need it. So this, you know, like, again, coming back to the title, practicing as if your hair is on fire. If somebody actually said with scriptures, she would be the object of kind of, you know, what does it mean, practicing like your hair is on fire? What would we do if, like, all of a sudden, like, something comes to the ceiling and your hair starts to burn? it's maybe for us it's not such a good time because we probably fly around like every chicken and run around and go, ah, 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 you know. Because we're not disciplined, the mind is not trained, we go into panic. But that's not what it meant, that you kind of run around like a headless chicken. It's more meant that, what would you do if your hair is in front of you? Let's say you're about to go and look if there's a biscuit somewhere in that bowl over there, you know, the biscuits that you like. That's your intention, that you're going to look for the biscuit. Then on the way there, something drops, like burning oil or something. And your hair, for two of us, you know, such a good example. But if you have hair, or you close, okay, you can do your clothes. Your clothes kind of start to... Would you still first think, oh, first I go and see if there's a cookie there and then I'll do something at the fire. This is us. First I arrange everything outside so that I can practice. First, you see what we want to do? First I have to make my mind happy so that I can practice. But it doesn't work like that. Because your mind will be happy through the practice. And it's true, as long as the mind is very tense and very unhappy, the results will be small, but you still have to learn to practice with an unhappy mind. If we wait so that we can practice, and the practice then goes easy, so that then we can practice. Well, we can wait for a long time. It's like saying, I will, to benefit others, well, I have to wait until I'm Buddha, and then I will benefit others, or something like that. Or, you know, I will attain enlightenment once. I first have to be a Buddha, and then I will attain enlightenment. Or first I have to be a Buddha, then I will do the practices to become a Buddha. It's not going to work like that. So the more you study the teaching, the more you see how this all fits together and that you really have to go in step. And you have to do those practices in the right order. Anna, do you know?
Yes.
Anna said, you know what you said about joyful practice? That is one... Actually, that's really... If your hair is on fire, the greatest joy for you would be to put it out. And so you think, how can I put out this fire? And you go and find something that will really help. You're not going to the kitchen to put more oil on. You will stick it under water, or you put a blanket over it or something like that. So it doesn't mean that we should panic. It means that we have to think what will help. That's what it is, practicing like your hair is on fire. And then everything becomes trivial. But now, that doesn't mean then you stop going out and earn some money because you have to do it. That doesn't mean that, you know. It means you still do the things you need to do in order to survive, but it means you make some choices and you let go of the things you don't need. But in order to be able to do that with a happy mind, again, first you have to know that we're sick. It's much easier for somebody to give up something when they know they have a sickness, like smoking. You know, everybody wants to give up, well, not at the beginning, but after a while with smoking, people want to give up. Yeah? Very difficult. The moment you know that you have lung cancer, maybe easier. And actually, if you want to give up smoking to somebody else that you are attached to, that's the easiest. Because it's fairly easy for a woman to give up smoking when she knows that she's pregnant. So there again, you know, this whole thing, we think we're very selfish and we are very selfish, but if there's somebody in our lives that we have interest for, if the interest is there to have the other person well or happy, then it's very easy to give things up. Very easy. But this is, again, then we have to enhance that love for others, for all others. So that we let go of our short-lived pleasure now and can practice. So this is how all those thoughts will help. But you have to think those thoughts again and again and again and again. So we would all like to have joyful effort, right? Because once you have joyful effort, then there's no more effort. So actually, joyful effort, what does it mean? It means having joy in being able to practice virtue. So if somebody, you know, a guy would say, okay, well, we talk today, let's stop. Now, here, let's stop and then, you know, let's go to an air-conditioned movie. Going to watch a really nice, relaxing movie, yeah? We'd be happy. Not done it.
Because I was working a lot during the week, and I just used it as a holiday to sit in the car.
Yeah, so I'm very happy about being here. Right. So then some people will be very disappointed. This will be the people who really want to practice, the people who want to practice, the people who sacrifice something for the practice. For those people for whom the practice is the sacrifice, then that, you know, like they feel like they're sacrificing, you know, if they feel unhappy. But you know what I mean, yeah? So then, you know, they'd be very happy to say, oh, great, please, I can go and be a bit more comfortable, a bit more cool, and you don't have to think for anything anymore. So this is what it means, you know, your hair is on fire, you find something to put the fire out, you're very happy. Even if, like, you know, now sticking your head under, if somebody puts a blanket over your head, you'd be very unhappy. It's all relative, this whole thing. We need to know why we want to blanket over our head. We need to know why we want to practice. And there you need to have a very long view. And the longer you view, which means like this one, I want to be of benefit to all sentient beings, the more effort you can put into this whole thing. The more you know, you know, whenever the complaining mind comes up, complaining is so harmful. We have to be really, really, really aware of our complaining mind. Because at times nobody but ourselves. Oh, it's too difficult. Oh, I can't do that. Oh my God, it's too hot. It doesn't make the temperature any cooler. It just increases the tension in your heart. And then it makes it real. This is the thing. Think about emptiness. Merely labeled. It's relatively hot. But if you think this is really hot, and of course it becomes really hot. Because your words make it real. Your thoughts make the thing real. Reify them. Make them very solid. Yeah. You think this is hot, you wait until you get to the hotel. Then you'll be quite happy to be in a hot room. You can remember. Yeah. It's another good thing to think, you know, oh, Dharma practice is too difficult. It's, you know, we must have endured the suffering in the lower states so many times already. So many times. So compared to those suffering, the suffering from Dharma practice is small. It's very small. But we, in order to have a little bit of pleasure now, we almost choose the suffering in the lower state. Because that's far away, so I don't care about this now. Yeah. Now I want to be comfortable and I want to be safe. But you have to be very, very careful when you think those thoughts. This is what you have to really make those first steps first. This is what people hear, and then they push and push and push and they burn themselves up. Because the right attitude is not there. You know, people always say, yeah, but you have to find the right balance. The right attitude is not there, you will never find the right balance. Never. It's the attitude that is, you know, the view, the attitude. What do I want? That is what people, what will give you the right balance. Because the more you want it, the more energy you will have. So if you really want to practice, if I would say now it's finished, you go to the movies, then going to the movies would be suffering. Go to the movies? Then also what we need is like the faith, you know, the faith that we can attain a state which is free from all suffering. The faith that I can climb on top of that mountain. I have the possibility to do that. The faith that being there will be a good thing. That stronger. But there again, you see there's different kinds of faith. So there's the faith of doing something, make sense, and then do it. When we were children, we have this kind of faith. You know, we hear what grown-up people say. We don't really know if it's true or not, but we trust. And then we do it, and if there are those people who said that, those things, if they were wise and really want us to benefit, then we end up quite well. You know, there will be not that much suffering as a meditation. But if kind of grown-up people play games with us, which they very often do, and it's very cool to play games with kids like that, to use their trust in mind, to misuse their trust in mind to have a joke or to do a game. That's very harmful. Because that child only remembers that. Shouldn't trust people, be careful. It's not good. It's not fair, you know, just because you have more intelligence than them, it kind of makes sense. As kids already do that, you know, with children who are a little bit mentally handicapped, we used to do that at school, we had one girl.
It's very true.
And we feel good about it. So, faith, yeah? Like again. So the first faith that we have is we just believe it by thinking, what can I use? And that faith is good enough. Because that faith makes you engage, makes you do the things, and then slowly, slowly you see that it works, and you get different faith, which is faith from doing. And then when that faith becomes stronger, you can make more effort, because you have more interest. Then when, because you make more effort, because you have more interest, then you have more experience, and so it goes on. But we cannot wait until we have the faith of experience before we start practicing. We just have to jump. But we don't jump blindly. So I think it was Tigger Conquering Victory. He teaches around here sometimes. So if you see anywhere poster with Tigger Conquering Victory, he's amazing. He's a label, he's Tibetan, who had years and years and years of depression. Came to the West, fell into deep, deep, deep depression. Even such a mind, you know, not just the body, but also their mind can go into it. And then when he came out of it tonight, he became beautiful, amazing. And he knows the Western mind really well. It's a very good way of teaching and of supposed to meet. It's very, very slowly. Finishes his sentences. Finishes what he started to say. Because I just open a big can of worms kind of around. And he says, one third here, one third here. And I said, sometimes at the end, they all come together sometimes. Tigar Konkul Rinpoche. So he gave a very nice example of how that kind of faith in the Buddhist path. I mean, he said a few things. And what he says, it sticks to the mind. You know, it goes, it's a few events. Oh my, you never forget it. The one thing he said is like, we Westerners, with our critical intelligence, he was very polite, you know, he could have said cynicism, because we think we're so intelligent, yeah? And then people who have faith in deities, mantras, like we look down on them and think, oh, they're stupid. They're superstitious, yeah? And we think we are any better. We actually, if you go into, who is stupid, it's them who are all stupid, and I was one of them, because that's why I'm allowed to say that. Because I didn't even try. I say, that's superstition, I'm not going to do that. It's just pride. Okay. When I was in Mexico, I was really amazed how many miracles happen in Mexico. And they really happen. Why? Because people believe in it. They don't happen in Europe. Because why? Because people don't believe in it. They don't allow the miracles to happen. It's all merely labor. And we think we are more, you know, we look down on them. They're much more smart. At least they try. At least they open up, you know, for the miracle. But you also have to practice it. So that's one thing he said. We Westerners or you Westerners, with your critical intelligence. Well, at one point, it's good. It's good to investigate. But at one point, you have to choose something. You have to make a decision whether you want to start practicing or not. You just take. Nothing will happen. And then he says, and then it's like a map, you know? You know you want to go somewhere. You know where you want to go, but you don't know the way. So you're asking somebody, and that person draws a map for you. So you have two choices. Either you trust the person, and you just go in that direction as opposed to that, or you don't trust, and then you go where you want. You still don't know. But if you really want to get there, it's better to trust and to believe. Just blind believe. Because how can you know? Maybe you judge a bit instead of asking somebody who's completely drunk. You ask somebody who is sober. You know, that's probably the only thing that you could do. Still not knowing whether the sober person knows better than the drunk. So then, you know, it says like different places. So then you say, okay, I want to go from here, let's say to here. But first I have to go here, then here I have to turn left, and here I have to turn right, and, you know, he says, this corner here, there's this and this shop, or this and this shop, and this and that. So if you see first is blind faith. Then you go and you see, oh yeah, the first one, that's right, there's the sidewalk, that fade. Yeah. The next one, you say, oh yeah, that's right, there's this thing. And as you go along, your faith increases. So even you haven't arrived yet, but, you know, pretty much in the middle of it, if you see that everything is right, yeah, then you see, oh wow, yeah. And then you go, then the faith is very strong. And this is why study in spiritual practice is very important. I mean, you need to know the basis, you need to know the path, you need to know the result of it. Otherwise, how can you have this faith? And the more you study, especially the people with the higher studies, the more you study and you see how, like, you know, how the mind works, mental factors, and the five paths and all that, how this really fits together. And even if it doesn't work in your mind yet, you see that, you know, this path is very, very clearly mapped out. And you can always see where you are. So that's why a kind of study is important. Another thing that helps to see how privileged we are, to feel privileged to be here instead of, oh, how long is this going to last? It's just attitude. I mean, how many people have access, or, you know, it's not the access, not the Buddha's fault, it's the people's kind of choice. How many people really have access to very clear instructions how to attain state to freedom from suffering? And how many people still believe that the suffering comes from outside? They're very privileged. Just to hear that, it's your mind who's creating the suffering. Changes everything. How many people know that? Not many. Very privileged. You see, the moment you feel privileged, you take good advantage of that thing. You know, like, let's say, somebody, what's the most expensive hotel in town? Hold on. So let's say somebody gives you a voucher to go to the Pan Pacific 24 hours. You feel privileged. You take advantage. You go and look everywhere. You're very happy. You know, you're not bored. Because if you live there, yeah. But the thing of feeling privileged, we don't live in the Dharma. We don't know where we're going to be in our next life. In this life, we're very privileged. It's not going to last. So we have to be like the visitors in the Pan Pacific. What is it? No, I'm just joking. Ah, yeah. Okay, so then as we go along, then, you know, first we think about permanence and death, like precious human rebirth and permanence and death, how, what to do at the time of death, karma, those things. As we practice that will prevent the states in the, you know, rebirth in the lower state. When you practice karma, when you think about karma, yeah, you practice morality, practice morality. But then we're still in samsara, like even being human, even going to the Buddhist center, even, you know, like being in San Francisco, still we suffer. We still have to die. We still have moments when we don't have what we want, moments when we have what we don't want, you know, all the time. So we have to become aware. But it's still not good enough. So then one wants to get out of samsara, and then one starts to look around and see, hey, I'm not the only one on this planet. There's many other beings who undergo exactly the same suffering. And in order to attain liberation for myself, I need the help of others. So then we create a generate what's called disposed chitta mind, which makes your mind very expansive, which makes the whole practice much more alive, much more meaningful. Even if we're not even, haven't even entered the path, but at least we know where we want to go, not just for myself. Gives you tremendous courage, you know. If you wake up in the morning, just saying, just today, you know, purpose of this day is not just for me to have pleasure and happiness. May I be a benefit to somebody? Even you don't know how to be a benefit, you know? But it's just training the mind instead of looking for our own pleasure, then slowly, slowly, and you get this incredible feeling of self-confidence. Just that, your depression goes out of the window. Not the first day, of course. But if you wake up and you feel like, hey, purpose of my life is to benefit others. There's nothing else. And slowly, 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 you develop tremendous courage and self-confidence. And then you look, okay, how? Then they give us Mahayana path, which is becoming a bodhisattva and then doing what? What does a bodhisattva do? Huh? Yeah, practice the six perfections. There's no microphone, but he's going on repeating it, okay. What are they? Do you remember? Microphone.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Generosity.
Yeah. Meditation is not another word, isn't it?
That's number five.
Okay, so skip around.
Try not to skip around because there is a reason for this order, and we'll come to that. This is what.
Then I can tell you I don't know six.
Not that I have a mind off the chair.
I'm pretty sure you know. Somebody knows the six attitudes.
Generosity, ethics, patience, glorious effort, concentration, wisdom.
So, joyous effort, that thing that we would like to have, is number, which one?
Four.
So we would like to have it without practicing the first three. And that's not possible. This is why they come in that order. You see, when you start to practice generosity, really just giving freely, first whatever you can spare, then always pushing a bit, pushing a bit, pushing, more, 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 you know? Like, I said at home, I said, I wonder what would happen if I would just really give everything away. I think I said that last time I did it. It's quite amazing. Somebody very down to earth just said, oh, you would just start accumulating again. And it's true. We're always so afraid, you know, oh, then I won't have anything. But then we start accumulating. Yeah. I mean, if you look, people who lose everything in a storm or by war or whatever, the moment they settle down again, even as they go along, you know, even the homeless people, I saw somebody yesterday with three or four huge garbage bags hanging from the cabin. Yeah. You also see the state of their mind. But I tell you, again, I come back to the homeless, I really admire how they can live like that. I get tense when I don't know where to put my things. Like a little bit of tension in the day, but it's so good. So good. Yeah. Yeah, we have to retreat that thing.
So there's many of the homeless are also very generous, way more than me. Because you might offer them something and they'll take it, and they won't have anything, and they'll give half of it to someone else, or they'll say, oh, you know, that person over there really needs it more than I do, and they'll point it to someone else.
Because they have learned. Because they suffer, right? So they know how this is. Maybe they also had a night without blankets or whatever, but now they have one. So they know how it feels when you're really, really cold. It's quite amazing. It's really quite amazing. So if we've learned to give, it's a training again. Six perfections, we have to train them. Actually, perfection means paramita, means kind of the path to go beyond. You know the heart sutra? Kattegatte, paragatte, paragatte, gone beyond. Yeah, like kattegatte means like gone, and then paragatte is gone beyond. The paramita is like the path to go beyond. Perfection maybe not such a great translation, because for us perfection is a goal that we have to attain, and that's it. But they are not there per se. Just like that, as a goal, the goal of that is the training to go beyond. And you have to go, that's why you have those instructions, where you have to go in the right order. So you learn how to give freely, then you're less entangled in your possessions. And it's much easier to keep the second one, which is ethical conduct. you're not so attached to your things, and you know you don't want to amass so many things, you're much more ethical. It's really sad, you know, to see how many rich people are so unethical when it comes down to their money. Cheating, stealing even, you know, like stealing in a very subtle way, bribing, extort, huh? Yeah, rich people shoplifting. Because their mind is miserly. You know, richness is like being rich or poor, that's got nothing to do with how much you have in your bank account. It kind of has to do again with your attitude. So somebody who learns to be content with what they have, they're much richer than the richest person who is not content. Maybe the shoplifting, they do it for the thrill, maybe. Because they're so bored. So boring when you have everything. But shoplifting is kind of really rare. But you know, when they use their power and their money to get more money and kind of exploit the poor, that's really bad karma. So what kind of karma does that create? It creates the karma for them to be poor in the future. And they're completely, you know, their attitude or their view is, the more I cheat, the richer I get. Not seeing that them being rich now, that's an act of generosity from the past. And they're completely destroying all that effort they've made in the past by using their position now in order to get more, which they, you know, even if they live three lifetimes, are not able to spend. We have to be very, very careful, knowing that we have in abundance. And abundance means you don't, it doesn't mean you don't have to go out and work. But abundance means you don't have to worry so much about food, clothes, shelter and medicine when you're sick. That means you have, that's a good sign that we have created generosity in the planet. We have access to those things. Not really, not for free, but we don't have to worry about it. And we're, oh, there's another thing. You're not aware how privileged we are. Are there very, very few members in society who have to, who don't have to worry about them. Very few. We're really a minority. And more so. So if we're not so attached, then the second of the six perceptions is morality. So that's much easier to keep, you know, when you're not attached. Because it's out of attachment that one creates a lot of non-virtue. So practicing morality or ethical conduct is a wish, it's not the wish to help yet, but it's a wish not to harm. When you have the wish not to harm firmly in your mind, it's much easier to practice the third perfection, which is patience. If the wish of no harm is not in the mind, it's very difficult to practice patience with somebody who's harming you. Almost impossible, because we talked about it over lunch, because that's the normal way of behaving. Getting angry at somebody who is harming you. Because there is no wish of non-harm. So sometimes it seems to me, it is as if like Israel and Lebanon, they are waiting to be harmed so that they can attack. So that they have a good reason to attack. And when you listen to both sides, they are both convinced that they are right. That's the thing, that's the sad thing about it. They're not lying, they have trained their mind or conditioned their mind in such a way that they, you know, they see the attack and then they retaliate. It's the same as with the politicians. They are convinced what they're saying is true. They convince themselves to believe their own lies, but that's why they come across so kind of self-confident. If they would know that they're lying, it wouldn't be so bad, because then they could change their views, but they cannot change their views because they think they're right. So then by practicing patience, it's then if you start to really practice patience, meaning looking for people who are difficult, but for that you have to have a very strong mind. Yeah. Because what we do, we try to avoid them.
Yeah.
And if we have to endure, we always count the days, how much longer do I have to be together with this person? And we console ourselves saying, oh, come on, don't worry. But that's good for at the beginning of your practice. That's okay. I also do that spontaneously. This is why what we do. You see, I tell you, you start to observe your own mind, you know the mind doesn't get away. We all understand. So instead of going like this, which makes you very weak and very vulnerable and full of fear that, oh, there might be a problem, you go, great, I still have a whole week to practice patience. Reminding yourself, oh, but I'm a bodhisattva. I need to practice patience. I need that person. So when we look in the section of, yeah? You want to share something?
No, nothing about it.
Yeah. What's that?
We were just noting that 14 more years is all youngest.
Oh, I see that. That's what you think, 14 more years. Maybe it's 30 or 40 more years. What did somebody say at one point? Told me, small children, small problems. Big children, big problems. So don't put your hopes up too high. Yeah, because then they come with their marriage problems and their children problems. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How old are they?
4-year-old twins and 7-year-old.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, kids are great for patience. Because also, I'm not joking. Because with the kids, because they love, so there's this natural wish of not finding. That's why patience is much easier to practice with the children than with somebody who is unpleasant to you in the street. Yeah. They're also very challenging because you seem stuck with them, all kind of at least, for 14 years, let's say.
Most of the time it's wish for not.
Yeah. So when we look at patience, because, you see, patience of the mind is very strong. It cannot be disturbed by difficult conditions. Yes, of course that has to be trained, because our mind, a little bit of pain in the knee, while we're meditating, already the mind is disturbed. A mosquito around your head while you're meditating. Meditation finished. It's a mosquito. And this is good to see, to see that you can relax when you know that you have no control. You can still meditate and be in your meditation when you give up wanting to protect yourself. As long as you kind of hope that the mosquito is going to find somebody else. you're not calm. Whereas you say, okay, I'll offer my body, it will bite me once or twice, it will not kill me, you relax. And then probably go to somebody else. But if you think like this or goes to somebody else, then you don't go to somebody else. This is not patience, and this is what we mistake with patience very often. We kind of go, oh, I'll watch the pain, then it will go away. That's not patience. Patience is, it's okay for the pain to be here. It's okay for the mosquito to be here. One, patience allows. Whenever you allow, you give space. Whenever you give space, you come more in contact with the clear nature mind. Once you're in contact with the clear nature mind, even if it's a lot of pain, you're okay. Yeah.
I have a question about patience. Lately in my life, I've been facing the teaching in general, mm-hmm. We need to express, and that's kind of when I have the perspective of, the Buddhist perspective on this, you need to express your feelings, not to suppress them, and because they're supposed to destroy you, destroy you or harm you if you suppress your feelings. So in patience, for example, you're living with a person who you can't deal with, mm-hmm. and you're experiencing anger,
mm-hmm.
Or many different feelings, and so what is a good way to oppose the impatient?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very difficult question to answer because it very much depends on the situation. Now, if you are a true bodhisattva, then of course you cannot be harmed. There's this the sticker that says, no anger, no enemy. Because if the enemy is not outside, the enemy is in your mind. Now, who allows the person to harm you with words? It's you. But it's, you can't start like this, right? You have to know about creation, human rebirth, impermanence and death, karma, and all those things, and then you can, this is why, then you can start practicing those things. This is why they come at the end of the path. But very often, because we see, oh, if I would have patience, then my mind would be much more peaceful. That's true. But you cannot develop patience if you don't know who and what you are. That there's nobody there who can get harmed. There's a person there, but what is getting harmed is the self-cherishing. Somebody tells you, oh, you're an idiot. It's just words. But because we feel this separate I, and this is too complicated to explain kind of in this short thing. So I would say just continue with the practice and then you know how to react. Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with protecting yourself. And actually, I would say, go away before you are, this anger completely overwhelms you. Then you protect yourself and the other person, because this anger will make you harm the other person. Expressing feelings by words when you are angry, this is never a good idea, because you exaggerate. You only see your point of view, and then the other person doesn't believe you. Expressing anger just because you don't want to be hurt or harmed is not a good thing, because you forget about the happiness of the other person. But if you want to stop the other person to harm you because you know that it doesn't make the person happy, because harming somebody doesn't make anybody happy. If you have this in your mind, then you can do something actively without making the problem any bigger. So the first thing, you know, the Tibetan would say, go away. Go away and practice from the distance. Practice loving kindness. Practice an open heart that wants the person to be happy. You know, and then that open heart and the wish for the person to be happy will allow you to see from the person's point of view what would make them happy. But you know, kind of giving you direct instructions or dreams is important for the next situation. We mustn't forget, we will always have conflict with others. Because, you know, we have so much conflict with ourselves. At one point I like this, and the next day I don't like it, and then I want this, and then I don't want this, and then I want to practice, but I also want to go to the movies. It's like, how can we expect not to have conflict with others if we're already in conflict with ourselves? So conflict is not the problem. But then making it real and true, and you see, the same way as we harm others also with our words and with our behavior. Not so much because we want to harm them, just because we want to have happiness or we want to have less suffering. The problem is when somebody harms us, we think they harm us because they want to harm us. They don't want to harm us, they do it for because they want to be happy. So if we can just see that, then that takes away a lot of the harm or the hurt. We see their harm as what? Because they're unhappy. So being very, you know, so if you tell them again and again and again and again how unpleasant they are, that's not going to make them happy. Good to say from time to time, but you have to be very careful. Sometimes it's quite amazing actually by practicing patience, by just, you know, making sure that you're not getting angry. That's your first job. Make sure you're not getting angry, and for that you need to know how to think. You need to know about karma really, really clearly and really well. Then that, you won't get angry anymore. And then, you know, wanting to change the other person so that they can't harm you. As long as you have karma to be harmed, you will get harmed. That's the way it is, you know. Sometimes people feel hurt, but the other person wanted to help them. So, I mean, you know, try to really see, why is this person doing that? Do they want to harm me? Or maybe they want to help me? Maybe they want to show me something. Of course our self-cherishing doesn't like criticism. Yeah. Of course our self-cherishing always wants what I want, because that's the right way of doing things, or that's what I want. You see, with self-cherishing, we are in relationships, or couples, or families, we are quite ready to give up our own self-cherishing, but we demand the other to give it up as well. No need. If you want to have harmony between two people and one consciously gives up self-cherishing, problem is solved. You can be that one. But for that you need to have very, very strong, healthy self-confidence. And so that you don't become the martyr. You see, that's also from Sigar Konkurinpuchi. If you choose to be the weaker one, if you choose to be flexible and give in, it's not suffering. It's courage. But if you feel forced to be the weaker one, that's suffering. But you can choose to be the weaker one. But yeah, it's a bit dangerous to, I don't know what level you stand in your practice. Like people here in the front, I can talk like this, no problem, because we have to push ourselves. But other people who are pretty much at the beginning of the practice, they can be completely destroying them. Because then they think they have to become doormats, and then they go and practice like this. Nobody practices to be a doormat, you know. Doesn't mean. The meaning, you know, practicing patience doesn't mean you have others let, you know, you let others walk over you. Because you understand it's not good for them. It makes them unhappy. But this is that then we want to defend ourselves. But if, as long as we have that much expectation still, it's very, it's not good. First thing is always kind of, if I have no karma to be harmed, this other person cannot harm me. So what's my best protection is I stop to make more karma that comes out of anger and aggression. So expressing ourselves, that's good, but not necessarily the best thing. Sometimes it really works, we understand, we relax, we don't say anything, and the person's attitude changes. Because they don't feel attacked. If we express our feelings, they feel attacked. Especially if we express our feelings with anger, because anger is the issue. So the patience is that, but you know, with patience, we kind of go in doses. Yeah? The first one learns to be patient here, it's hot. Okay, it's hot. So you learn to relax the mind in a hot room. But we don't do that because we think it's not worthwhile, because it's not so big, you know. So then we don't train with small steps. Or you have to wait in a line, you feel the tension coming up. And then you give yourself the reasons by saying, come on, it's okay, just like that. You know, you say to yourself, it's all right, I'll get there one time, you know. Impermanence, the view of impermanence is the best thing to practice, so it will finish at one time. And then to see the relativity of the whole thing, you know. You see, a very good meditation is like, when we just think about ourselves, our problem becomes cosmic. So big. And then you visualize, you close your eyes, you visualize yourself here with your problem. And then you visualize a family in Lebanon. Now, where is your problem? Where is your hurt? Gone. And then you start feeling guilty. You see, we do those meditations for the self-cherishing. So the self-cherishing actually starts to feel ashamed. You know, the self-cherishing goes, oh, I'm suffering so much, they hurt me so bad, and it's not just, and I'm the victim, and poor me, whatever. So you do this meditation. You with your cosmic problem here. The family in Lebanon who has just lost two kids, maybe the father, the house, maybe even pro-Israeli, who knows, Christian, something like that. It has nothing to do with this war. The force, the strength, the fanaticism is not there. And then you have to run away to Syria without anything. Your self-cherishing will feel so ashamed. You will go. This I think we can do. This is very good. If you want, you see, if your self-cherishing is so weak that it blows every problem completely out of proportion, you will always have problems. Somebody looking at you the wrong way will do this. You are the one who is allowing the other person to find you by not understanding what's going on and by making the problem cosmic. By just seeing your own, by not seeing the relativity. But be careful. Be careful that you don't become the doormat. Or if you become the doormat, be the happy doormat. Saying, being able, but without cynicism, being able to say in your mind, not directly, to the other person, thank you very much for purifying my negative karma. You see, every time we get hurt, we purify negative karma. And actually, on his opening visit, he was at LMB. He came to visit Bhikkhu briefly. And he said, you know, for anything you want to do, first you need to do purification. So he said, for enlightenment, of course you need to purify. That for good rebirth, of course you need to purify. And he said, even in business, if you want to succeed, you need to purify. You need to purify the negative karma. As long as we have negative karma, we will not find what we want. So this person purifies for you. You don't have to do anything. They bring up your negative interests. But again, people can understand it in such a wrong way. You know, thinking, well, it opens the door to you. Actually, it doesn't. That's the best protection that you can give yourself, is stop creating more negative karma by reacting out of anger and self-censure. That's the best way. Then we don't need walls and deaths and bombs and whatever. As long as we have so much self-censure and so much negative karma in people's minds, we will have bombs and deaths and whatever. The patience is first to start small with outside conditions. The next step is to start practicing with people who harm you. Only then, once you have learned to relax the mind with non-animate objects. So, because it's quite easy to do, you know? I mean, if you get out in the street and then it starts to rain, you don't have an umbrella. Of course, on a day like this, you don't have an umbrella. Then what do? You look up the sky and say, how dare you give me this water and make me completely wet? You're angry, yeah? You wouldn't do that. Because you know you have no control. So you would be wet, but there is no anger. If somebody is kind of angry already, you hear an argument in the house, and these people are very angry, and then they throw a bucket of water out, and then it hits you, you get angry. The result is the same, you're wet. But in one, you know, in one occasion, you feel kind of they have no right to do this because you think you're in control. You have to fall. The other occasion, you like this guy. Well, and those people didn't even have the intention to hit you with their water. They didn't even know you were there. Still, we get angry. It's again, it's a natural reaction. I was also somewhere, I can't remember where. It doesn't matter. Walking in the street. And there is like, it just rained, and then there's those puddles, yeah? So a car drove through it, and quite fast, a car too fast, and it went. And I was completely wet. So my first thing was like, you know? And then I thought, hey, what are you doing? And then, you see, the first thing is like, I wanted him to see how wet I was, so that he would feel bad. This was, when you watch your mind, you see the intention. And then I persuaded him, I said, oh, it's okay, don't worry, to make sure that he didn't feel bad. This is the practice in daily life. You watch your mind, you watch your intention. Because I could have gotten very angry and said, what? I'm still wet. It doesn't dry my clothes. But waving at him and just saying, don't worry, it's okay, I'm relaxed. I'm just wet. But I'm not angry and I don't suffer. But we have to, oh, you have to be more careful. I know how it is when you're in a car. Sometimes you don't see the puddle. But if you're not in a car, you think that you saw the puddle and you did it on purpose. But some people do. But that's their problem. Okay, so that's the second patient. So also, first you train with people that are not so close to you. People who don't hurt or harm you so much. Yeah? And in your situation, again, I don't know, maybe you do have to move away. But keep the heart open for the person. It's very difficult to change people, you see. Very difficult. We can only really change our own mind. Of course, it would be much easier if we could change everybody else's mind, and then we wouldn't have to change our mind. And by trying to change our own mind, wanting to change the mind by practicing, we can see how difficult it is. So we start to understand how difficult it is for people to change habits. Now the third kind of patience is patience with the Dharma. That's another kind of patience that we need. Meaning we are patient when the results don't come immediately and still have faith and still continue to practice. And very often we forget that. Now, when you do that and you just continue to practice, more and more things go smooth. Not outside conditions, not necessarily, but sometimes even though it starts to kind of even themselves out and everything goes much smoother. And then, when everything goes much smoother, then the joyful effort. That's the perfection number four. And that one is the best antidote for laziness. That's true, but without practicing the other two first, we will not have joyful effort. This is why it goes in those steps. Yeah? Like that. Then with joyful effort, it's much easier to create concentration. Yeah, because that's very difficult. You have to just meditate on one object again and again and again and again and again. And then with concentration we'll get wisdom, seeing emptiness correctly. So those are the six perfections of the bodhisattva, which anybody can train that. You don't have to be a bodhisattva to train those six things. And it will make you a very strong person, a very autonomous person, a stable person, a happy person, practicing those six things. Do you have any questions or do you want to say something? Okay, so then laziness, yeah? How to overcome laziness? Huh? Anybody else have good ideas? Because I'm lazy myself, that's the problem. I thought, well, I come and give the talk and maybe somebody has some better ideas. If I can overcome my laziness in an easy way. Because what we did until now, what we discussed until now, those are the preparations, yeah, to overcome laziness. So how to overcome laziness itself? I think again, you know, it's like you have to have some fear, otherwise you will be lazy. You have to have fear of the suffering, otherwise you will be lazy. I have this habit, I read this somewhere in a textbook, I found it extremely helpful, but I still don't see it. But maybe some of you might think that, you know. It's like, you know, I have this thing sometimes in the morning. I think, oh, just 5 more minutes. And I'm convinced that those 5 more minutes will make a difference. Maybe I slept 5 or 6 hours and I'm still tired and I think the 5 minutes will make a difference. I'm convinced. And that prevents me from getting up. And then I'm late because from the 5, then it's 7, then it's 1. Can you relate to that?
Yeah.
Right. So then they said, if a poisonous snake would fall on your bed, would you say, oh, I'm so warm, and that's 5 more minutes, you know, when you see the thing coming there. Yeah. Poisonous snake is dead, and permanent, okay? And we're not frightened of it. We don't see what will be a benefit at the time of death. It's like those 5 more minutes that you spend in your bed, they're not going to help. We're not going to help us at the time, but maybe the getting up and doing a half an hour, just mindfulness, silent meditation in the morning.
Yeah.
It's another good thing to maybe start, maybe with 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You get up, instead of kind of going for your coffee, you sit with a straight back on your bed, in your pajamas, you know, and just do not so much blah, blah, blah with motivation, and blah, blah, blah. Just mindfulness. That's great. And then slowly, slowly expand. Very difficult to keep it up alone. Yeah, this is why I'm so happy to be a land of medicine Buddha. We do it in, like, whoever wants to come. It's like 45 minutes in the morning, and it's completely silent. Yeah, between the courses. So nobody has to say anything. You don't have to listen to anybody else's motivation. Right? So if you can get a group of people together, or if you are in a community, or in a relationship, and both of you have interest, to do half an hour but together. So much easier to do. And it has great effect on you. Just nice. Then of course if you're doing it with a good motivation, then you're good. But it doesn't have to be. Don't agitate your mind too much. Even with positive thoughts in the morning. Just let the mind be selected. And see how you feel when you get up and you do it, and see how you feel when you don't get up and sleep that half an hour longer. Really compare those two minds. Because we have to take steps on it. Yeah. And to see how when we have moments, we all have moments when we can be diligent. You know, we pull ourselves together and we do it. How that creates self-confidence, peace, calm, you know, that people don't feel good about themselves. If we are lazy, we have no self-confidence, we're not happy with ourselves, we're not happy with others, we complain about every little thing, you know. It's this whole thing again about deciding what we want to do. And then we do it. Yeah? And lazy people are very dull. Diligent people, but diligent in a way that you're not looking down on others. Oh, I'm so good and those are so lazy. Not like this. Just diligent because you want to do it. How does that sound? Do you think you can use that?
So I always think that I'll just spend those 5 minutes doing it as well.
The microphone.
I think about that, but then I just feel like I'll spend those minutes, 5 minutes, kind of closing off anyway.
Yeah. No, you won't. If you sit, you won't. It's not the same thing as being in bed. You have to sit with a straight back.
Oh, I can doze off too.
Then it is like, you know, like this dozing off in the meditation or during teaching. It's actually, it's negative karma from past life.
Yeah.
Laziness. Past laziness. That makes, this is what I'm saying, makes the mind very dull. When the mind is dull, it's not interested, it goes into sleep. Shuts down. So then what you do, you take the mind who is about to doze off, you take that as your object of meditation. As your focal object, you know what's going on in the mind. Don't allow the mind, you allow the, it's difficult to explain. You allow the mind to be drowsy or dozing off, but one aspect of the mind sees it, watches it, holds down. But really make sure that you're sitting completely with a straight back. This is important. Don't allow the body to go like this and don't close your eyes. You have to keep your eyes open, you need to go like that. When you feel that you're dozing off, don't allow the eyes to close. Of course they will, and then you don't go. But you see, if you make effort, slowly, slowly, you will lose that habit. If you just say, oh, that's the way it is, it will always be like that. Actually, there's something I forgot to say.
Only if I'm still very sick.
Yeah. Well, you know, if that snake falls in your bed, your sleepiness is gone. We would wake up so quickly. Or you would, you know, somebody would phone, or somebody would ring the doorbell, and you hear the voice of a person that you like very much, and you haven't seen the person in 3 years. Your sleepiness disappears. Somebody rings the bell and says, you won $1 million. Sleepiness gone. We don't see the flexibility of our mind sometimes. You know? That's it. We can jump from one extreme to the other, but immediately. Yeah, I forgot one thing to say, thank you. That you see people starting practicing and everything seems to be easy for them. And then there's asked, you know, it's a diet, somebody laziness, somebody mind who doesn't change and just not. That is very much dependent on past karma. You see, they say like this is why we're so fortunate. Not everybody can come in here. I mean, a few visitors came. They heard me talk, they just came to buy something and left. You know, or they went to have a look, what is this, and then they left. That's a sign of having no merit. That Dharma is there, but they don't have the energy to, or the karma to enter. There was another Lama in Bodhgaya who said at one point, the Dalai Lama was about to teach in Bodhgaya. And of course, in India, it's a big mess. There's like thousands of people. Nothing is organized like here where you have a number, where you sit, you have to fight for your seat, you know. It's dirty and it's dusty and it's like, you know, everybody sits like this and like that. So, there's another Nimbalama who was teaching, and he said, if you would know how much positive energy you have created, how much positive karma you have created, just to hear the word Dalai Lama, you would be so good. And then on top of it, receiving teaching from somebody like that, you know, one needs so much more. And then he said, and then what do? We go there and then we go, oh, there's too many people, I can't see him, I can't hear him, like, you know, oh, it's too dusty, it's too hot, it's too busy. It's because we don't see how hard we work to be able to be here, you know. I mean, you see, again, Janet's attitude, she worked very hard to be here today, so she doesn't want to miss this opportunity. But this is what we have to understand. We have worked very hard in past life in order to have access to the Dharma and to have a little bit of interest. Even if we're not as diligent as other people sometimes. Those other people have been more diligent than us in the past, that's all. And we can become just like them. You see, it says minds are beginningless. So my mind didn't start before the Dalai Lama's mind. My mind's been around just as long time as the Dalai Lama's mind. Why is he the Dalai Lama? Why am I on his service? Because he was more diligent. That's all. So by doing the right things, we can attain that state. Yeah? So don't judge yourself too harshly when everything kind of is stuck, seems to be stuck and be full of doubt. Know that this is a big part of your practice, is the doubt. It's just the ego, you know. The ego doesn't like when you practice because it knows that, ooh, you know, pretty soon you'll recognize what I am and then my days are counted, you know. Then it freaks out. And it's the self-cherishing that makes us feel lazy. And the self-cherishing has no wisdom. It comes up with all kinds of excuses. But we have to start to look behind those excuses. We're always so worried about making too much effort. We're hardly ever worried about making not enough effort. And it's by making effort the results will come and then the joy will come. And then you don't need to make effort anymore. But at the beginning, you know, what you need in your practice is like, Patience, that's the big thing. And then diligence, just not giving up, and effort. And those things don't come easy for us. Especially we in the Western society, we're not used to that we have to make such effort anymore. Our society makes our survival, our lives very, very easier compared to others who have to grow their own food, you know, build their own houses with their own hands. We just pay. Yeah. So, if one is aware of that, we don't judge ourselves too much if we choose to go around. And then also, you know, the full life that we have. Of course, then there's not much energy left for the practice. Yeah. But if we realize how hard we must have worked in ourselves, and thinking about that again and again and again and again and again and again. Then we start to appreciate, we start to feel privileged. The moment you feel privileged, you know, in this Pan Pacific or whatever it's called, you spend very few hours sleeping in that hotel. You want to, you know, use the big screen TV and use this and the bath and then you spend bubbles and this and that and go to the fitness room, you go everywhere. Then you come out and you're completely exhausted. So Pan Pacific, no good. But when we understand, it is this thing, when we understand how privileged we are, that this is not going to last, then we don't have to worry so much about going now. But this has to be a very deep understanding, not just intellectual. Problem with us is we stop at the intellectual level and then it doesn't come from here. And then, you know, we learn to develop habits. With habit, everything goes easier. So at the beginning, it is hard. But then once it has become a habit not to be lazy anymore, then it's okay. But we have to be realistic, so we check, what can I do? And then we are content and happy with what we're doing. That's another kind of contradiction. We have to be content with what we did today in order to be better tomorrow. These two things have to come together. If you're very distant with what you did today, you burn out very quickly. So whatever we do, however little it is, you can think, but you know you have to do more tomorrow. So you have to do the balance. The balance is in those two minds. And don't ask me how to know the balance. I don't know. You will know yourself. As you go along in the practice, you will become your own teacher. The same way as we learn when we have eaten enough, the same way we will learn when we have practiced enough. But we don't have any confidence in ourselves. We always doubt. So those two minds, you know, whatever we did today, very happy about this, but tomorrow I'll be more. Then maybe just briefly, the three kinds of laziness is that obstruct joyful effort, and then the three antidotes to that, and then we'll stop. Yeah?
Yes.
And then ask a comment about it, because I have my own interpretation. I feel very fortunate to have met Tibetan Buddhism about 12 years ago when I was expecting my first child. So my excuse has been I have to take care of my kids. And it's true, I take it as my practice. Patience, diligence, and again, I'm very, very fortunate to have met my Lama 6 years ago, the same year that my mother died. During this time, I have been studying in the Gelug tradition. About a year later, after I met him, I formally asked him to, for me to be his student, and also talk about practice. I kept thinking about preliminary practices in the Nyingma tradition. I told myself, I've done these practices. I do prostration, I do purification, and I've never counted them before. So I asked him, and he said, It's good to start counting now. So I did for a while, for a short time, and then got distracted again. About a couple of months ago, I realized what I was doing, and this is why I would like to share this. What has been helpful for me is to watch how my mind works. In general, I have determination and do other things. For example, in taking care of my daughters, I need time for my yoga practices because they're important to me. But I don't put as much effort in my formal sitting practice. I'm also training to be a docent at the Asian Art Museum, so I spend a lot of time studying. I do a very good job, so I'm pleased. I have no regret about that. But about 2 months ago, I attended a weekend teaching on the Heart Sutra. And the Lama talked about how in the West, people want everything fast. They don't want to do the preliminary practices. Yeah. And I've heard this before, but at that time, it dawned on me, Penny, what are you doing? You put effort into other things in your life. And for this very thing, the most, it's just,
it's okay, you can still do it too. That's important, that then, because otherwise you have guilt coming. I don't know if your expression says it to your attention. I hope it's not showing guilt and it's just regret. Because regret is the first step for something to change. If it's guilt, we look at it. That's very important.
Yeah. I felt regret and a certain humbleness in realizing that in past life, I must pray the same prayer.
Yeah.
Name it the Dharma. That is just.
This is, you know, the prayer. May my mind be moved
in the Dharma, go towards the Dharma, and my mind become the Dharma. When we realize, you know, and it's, you know, this is the problem. We have to, all of a sudden, by hearing it again and again and again and again, nothing moves in me. Right? So then the effort cannot come as we want it to come because we don't realize. And all of a sudden, boom, one sentence, one weekend, we understand how important that is. And then it works. We want it to work before. It won't work before. Yeah, because it's too much. And we feel guilty when we don't do the practices over there. And we can't force that experience that's very beautiful. We can't force it to come. It will come. It will rise in by itself and you start to realize, so fortunate. You have a mind that's interested in practicing the Dharma, no matter how little it is. No matter how little it is, we'll be content, but we know we have to be more. That's great. So actually, this is the thing, those are the two lazinesses. So of course, one is the laziness of just wanting to be lazy and not doing anything. This is a very bad habit that we all have, you know, thinking that this will make us happy, not seeing the disadvantage. The other laziness is keeping busy. That's the second laziness. You know that, oh, I have to have the perfect condition first outside, and then I practice. I do this first, and then I do that. Do this first, and then I do that. So like that. And then the third laziness is low self-esteem. Oh, I can't do this, this is too difficult. What good in nature? I don't have good in nature. You know, like this. Putting yourself down. Those are the two lazinesses. So there's very precise antidote for that. So the first laziness about being lazy is impermanence to death. First is in rebirth and then impermanence in death. Perfect conditions to practice now, it's not going to last. For sure it's not going to last. And as we go along, we become older and older and older, the mind becomes more and more stiff. Actually, it was really amazing, and for me, it was such an eye-opener, that Elder Hostel, they came to do the talk, and many of them came next and said, wow, that was so great, and I got so much out of it, and you know, then they said, you know, when you said this and this and this, and I was like, I didn't. So you see, the older we get, the more we don't hear anymore what is being said, because we're so conditioned that we hear what we want to hear. Sometimes we can say, well, they don't, all people don't listen. It's not that they don't listen, they hear what their mindset is able to hear. I was so surprised, you know, and not just one, quite a few of them. They were so enthusiastic and told me what they had heard. That's not what I said. That's what, wow, I'm going to be the same way. You know, we'll be the same way. Conditioned. Not the mind not flexible anymore. So impermanence and death. You know, we're getting older, so then it's more difficult to practice. We're always thinking, oh, when I'm old, then I'll be patient. Wow, old people are like small kids. They have no patience whatsoever if they haven't trained. Very difficult to deal with problems. And on top of it, like they have a body with craving all the problems. So if you don't practice patience now with small problems, you will not be patient anymore. Because patience is a mind that has to be trained. Then, just constantly being busy, yeah. This is like thinking about the suffering in samsara in general. You know, constantly kind of thinking about how nothing outside will make you happy. Then the low self-esteem, of course, then you think about worldly things that you have achieved who also needed a lot of effort. And then you get that self-confidence that you can do things as long as you're interested and you put your mind to it. And about Buddha nature, of course, and you think about the teachings that inspire you by practicing the exact, those teachings, they have attained that state. And then what always helps, you know, of course, Dharma practice is suffering because the problem is we want it to be easy and joyful, but it is actually suffering, but then the joy comes with time. Is much less suffering than the suffering in the lower state. And then, just to end, kind of, we have to develop three kinds of pride, which is not deluded pride. We have to develop it. So this is called the pride of action, kind of me by myself. So it's still my I will attend my. I will liberate all sentient beings, me by myself alone. So we're not constantly waiting for the teachers to help us. You know, when teachers are not around, oh, I don't have a teacher. I don't know what to do. It's like, you know what to do. You know, I mean, there's instructions that give you to decide. Even one just from books, so we can start. Instead of just waiting for the perfect person to appear and then just go bing and then think we're enlightened. They don't exist, those guys like that. Me by myself alone, I will engage now. Yeah? And then the second is the pride, what's called the pride of ability. So you become very strong and very self-confident, but without feeling superior to others. So we make sure it's not deluded pride. See, pride needs somebody else to compare. You feel good about yourself, you feel somebody who's less good than you. Then you feel pride. It's a good, it seems to be a good feeling, but it's completely ridiculous because you look the other way, there's definitely somebody who can do better than you. Yeah, but we tend then just to look down on those people so we can feel good. So we have to train the mind to feel confident, courageous, but not feeling superior to others. And then the other one is like pride in the face of disturbing emotions. So you become like the warrior. You battle. The only battles that you fight is your disturbing emotions. But with care and with loving kindness for the person in whom those disturbing emotions are sitting. Not for the disturbing emotion, but for yourself. You have to be gentle, caring. And if somebody's gentle and caring, they can be quite forceful because they want the person to be happy. So then it also says like here, I can't remember where I found it. I just made those few notes that are concerning. Be careful not to do lion's deeds with a rabbit heart. So meaning be realistic. If a rabbit tries to do lion's teeth, it won't live much longer. It's not that long. You know, it just runs out and goes, wah! Like this. And there's a leopard there, or a tiger, or something like this, and whoop! And the rabbit is gone. But don't overdo it. You know? Or like the text also, like a peacock in a lion, like a peacock in a grove, I think. It's a text of Wheel of Sharp Weapons. It says, certain... Like the peacocks can eat certain plants that are poisonous, but if another bird would eat it, it would kill them. But bodhisattvas can do certain actions that if you don't have a bodhisattva mind, you cannot do those actions. But do not do lion's deeds with a rabbit heart out there. But develop the lion mind on the system. By listening to the teachings, thinking about them, meditating. Slowly, slowly, gradually, stepping. So maybe we'll just do like a few minutes of meditation. Just straighten your back. Maybe close your eyes. And then we try to develop a contained mind that we have endured the hardships of sitting in this warm room. It's not hot, it's just warm. Now the medicine with a bumper is much hotter. We have been able to endure it. We have didn't run away. We made the decision to come here today, which is great. We tried to be very happy about it. We're so fortunate. It's so rare, but really try to feel how privileged we are hearing the words of the Buddha, sitting in front of Buddha statues, being amongst other people who don't want to destroy the world or exploit others, but everybody in this room is focused on developing a good heart and being of benefit to others. Just try to connect with all the beings in this room. It's so rare to sit in a group of people where no competition. Nobody wants to harm others. We're all very interested in developing this practice. It's so beautiful. And
because people like us, even if we make very slow progress, there's hope for the world. Great. So we very clearly recognize that just this one afternoon, that then this is not making us being enlightened tomorrow, but it doesn't matter. For the moment today, we work quite hard. If you're tired, it's okay. It's just like thinking like that, this mind of being content about having done a good thing. The thing that is really worthwhile doing. You see how you react? We've created so much positive energy that in the future we'll definitely rise in happiness. A delight. Creating the causes. Of course the results will be important. So immediately we share all the positive energy that we have created with all other beings. This positive energy is a small drop of light in the first house grows, like a plant that grows and it needs the right conditions. Fills your body and then spreads out from your body. And just send it to all the corners of this world where there's so much suffering, fear, mistrust, fighting, killing, abuse. Just send that light wherever you think it's needed. You can send it to people that you know personally. You can send it to a specific region where you can just let it spread out in the whole universe. See how it brings well-being, trust, happiness, and action for suffering. To the virtues of our merits of our practice, to transform the world, which the light from our heart represents loving kindness. The wish for all beings to be happy, all beings to be free from suffering, for all beings to be able to live in harmony. Enjoy the rest of the day. You earned it well.
Thank you for all your hard work.
Sure.
It's really amazing. Truly amazing.